Accession number 19927, Reel 2.
Major Dunning, Reel 2.
Right. The Norwegian guys, which I mentioned, so that confirmed that we're going to Norway. The troop I was in was given the task of landing on the quay. It's quite different, this, as opposed to landing on the beach. We had bamboo ladders, and we were going to go alongside the quay, scramble up the ladders, and then I was to go to a certain house where one of the senior employees of the cod factory was living, and get him to take us to the cod factory and give us certain papers out of his safe, etc. Let me explain. The object of the raid was to sail into certain places in the Lofoten Isles which were being used by the Germans who had requisitioned fishing vessels and were using the catch to extract an oil which was used for the manufacture of nitroglycerine and also vitamins for the people of Germany. And our task, it was really an economic mission to strike at the economy of the Germans, was to destroy the oil-producing plant, destroy the fishing fleet, capture the German garrisons on the island, which numbered 200 or 300. So everything went according to plan. On the way out, we called at the Faroe Islands to do a little dummy run and test our weapons, etc. But we got to the fields, into the Arctic Circle, without being detected, and we on the morning of March the 4th, we landed without being detected and were able to carry out all our missions. To cut a long story short, we destroyed four factories, destroyed 800,000 gallons of this oil. There was tremendous oil smoke pails going over the islands. We captured 215, I think it was, German prisoners of war, a dozen or so Quislings, brought back a couple of hundred volunteers, sunk four big ships, including the Hamburg, which was over 10,000 tons, and all this was achieved without a single loss. Not one person was killed or lost from our party. Absolute total surprise.
What did you see and do on the raid yourself?
Well, I went up to this house, got this man, got him to take us to the factory, open it up, etc., and give us any papers. I had a Norwegian guide with us, and or any important papers. There wasn't very much in the way of important papers there, we were able to get the demolition teams in without having to bash down doorways and get them to tell us what were vital pieces of equipment which couldn't be replaced quickly. Instead of just smashing everything, going for important pieces of equipment. It's very, very interesting. It's only been revealed recently that one of the objects of the raid, unbeknown to us, unbeknown I think to most people, was to bring back codes. And after the secret station, Bletchley, well, after that secret, it was revealed that the codes were brought back from the Lofoten Island raids, and there was a chap interviewed. A chap called Ede, whose diaries, he was a reporter during the war, had dinner with Churchill. I've got the cutting up here somewhere. And Churchill revealed to him at a dinner party that one of the unknown objects of the raid was to bring back codes from the Foulton Isles, and they were used by Bletchley for some time afterwards. But we didn't know anything about that, and there we are. So then we re-embarked without loss, brought back all these prisoners, 200 odd of them, and the volunteers, and a load of cod, because we only had basic rations, and we all lived on cod for 4 or 5 days on the way back. Quite nice for a treat, but not for 3 or 4 days. So that was Le Foulton Isles. Very successful raid, boosted morale tremendously at home, because the Blitz were going on then, and we settled down to more training in the Scottish coastal, west coast of Scotland. That was 41. We were prepared for certain raids during that year, but were all called off. And then the next big one was the Dieppe raid in 1942, of which I took part. By that time I was Sergeant Major. Lord Lovett promoted me at the age of 21 to be Sergeant Major of C Troop. Told me I was probably the youngest Sergeant Major in the British Army. And I was Sergeant Major of C Troop when we raided, took part in the Dieppe raid, which was a terrible tragedy in many ways. The only bright spot, the only successful part of that raid was the operation by No. 4 Commando, which completely carried out our objective, destroyed the gun battery, but it was the only successful operation of that fateful day, which ended in the loss of some, not all killed, but captured, wounded and killed, of some 4,000 Canadians. Lost 100 aircraft over the battle area, several ships. We lost 19 men in our efforts. Pat Porteous, my good friend Pat Porteous, got a VC there. And we did a very good job. That went according to plan.
Can you take me through it, step by step, as you remember it, please, from setting off?
Yes. Right. We were in Troon at that particular time, and we were told we had to go down south to train for an operation. Funnily enough, we went back to Weymouth, where we had been formed. We went back into billets and trained along the coast there for a raid, which was to destroy a battery. We didn't know where it was, in spite of a lot of talk there was subsequently that the operation had been leaked. As far as I know, there's no concrete evidence that it was leaked. What people fail to realise, in the same way that we knew in the invasion days of what would be likely periods for a German invasion, I mean high tide, full moon and all that sort of thing, the Germans also knew. And there was a lot of talk in 1942 of opening up a second front now. The Russians were reeling under the onslaught of the Germans. The Germans were at the gates of Stalingrad. The Americans were going to come into the war. They wanted a second front. Churchill was being pressed for a certain front. The Germans thought there might be because of all this pressure. And so, naturally, they were prepared and had plans to repel any invasion, which were likely to be on the periods when it was favourable for landing. And these plans were obviously being carried out at the time of the 19th of August 1942. And so the units there were ready, in as much as they were part of their drill for repelling something. And that's what really happened, and that's where the main party got caught. But we fortunately got in before first light. We had a very successful crossing. It was the biggest armada to that time, of landing some 5,000 odd troops with tanks. 28 tanks were lost there. But we got in before, because the object of the exercise was that two commandos, three to the east of Dieppe and four to the west would destroy the coastal six-gun coastal batteries, which were able to fire onto the vital landing beaches immediately in front of Dieppe. So we got ashore. Lord Lovett, our CO, had got a very simple plan, splitting the party into two. One party would land, that was C Troop, my troop, and frontal, scale the cliffs, and then the main party under Lord Lovett would land at a place called Keeperville to the west, and a big outflanking movement while we, after scaling the cliffs, went 100,000 yards in front of the battery and engaged the battery with fire to take their attention, well, to pin them down. And that was a simple plan. And it worked very effectively. We landed. It was just okay. We would land, as I say, 1,000 yards, scale the cliffs. The reason why we were chosen for this role, because C Troop, during that period of after Lofoten 242, had specifically trained in cliff climbing and mountaineering. We'd gone down to Wales in the latter part of 41, cliff climbing, mountaineering, and then done quite a lot of climbing. So we were the commando, number four commando climbing troop. So there were two gaps there and these precipitous cliffs, and the object of the exercise was to go up these cliffs, to these gaps in the cliff. There were two of them, both filled with barbed wire, so we decided the right-hand one would be a bit easier to climb. We had some Bangalore torpedoes, and we exploded those. That cut through the wire, enabled us to scramble up the cliff and then go along. Amusing, really, because the track up to the battery, the Germans had mined or put, and it was Minden, no, Achten Minden in German, you know, warning mine, and the French was Danger Mine, which is exactly the same spelling as in English, danger, mines. So, of course, the wags in the troop, as we went up, said, bloody obliging the Germans, you know, to put it up in English. We know she shan't have to tread there. Anyway, we got up to the battery, deployed, and at the appointed hour, nicely synchronised. We didn't want to open fire on the battery until everybody was in position. So it was a real crescendo of fire brought down on the battery. And so the point, and very simple control, when everybody is in position, the chap called Derek Mills Roberts, who was really the 2IC as a commander, would blow on his whistle and we'd let fly with everything. We'd had a couple more extra LMGs, so we had six LMGs, light machine guns, Brens. We had an anti-tank rifle. We'd taken the anti-tank rifle, it's interesting, this, not because we thought there'd be any tanks there, but by the gun battery was a flak tower, which was armour-plated. And we thought, well, Lovett thought that it would be a good idea to take the anti-tank gun and pepper this flak tower with armour-piercing rounds. And that they did, which of course was obliging for the fighter pilots, because that was one more flak tower out of action. And we opened fire. I was in charge of a 2-inch mortar, and we opened up that. We got the range. It was only about 200 yards from the battery. We could see the chaps there. And the first HE went into the battery area, saw it explode. Second one went to the right a bit, and the third one, the biggest stroke of luck I think in World War II, hit the ammunition dump, and that went up, and it's recorded elsewhere many times, like a firework display. But that the battery never fired. It had opened its coastal gun because the rest of the fleet carrying the main party had appeared over the skyline. It was light now, but that battery never fired again. So it was a coup de grace, that. And then Lovett had got worked round while this was going on, and worked round to the flank, and the signal went up, a very light signal, green over white over green, I can see it now, went up, and that was for us to stop firing, and they would go in with the bayonet to destroy the men and the guns, which they did. There's quite a bit of hand-to-hand fighting. Several chaps were killed. Pat Porter has got wounded. Both the officers of F Troop were killed, unfortunately. And Pat took over, although wounded. And the guns were destroyed. And then they came through us and then re-embarked on our beach. We sort of leapfrogged back, as they say in military parlance, keeping some chaps on the ground all the time. We were mortared, we suffered one or two casualties there, but nothing really much, and re-embarked. We were to go into reserve, if needed, onto the main beach, but by about 11 o'clock then, we had the order to come back to England, which we did, and of course we didn't know what terrible tragedies had been happening on the beach in the main party. As far as we know, 100% success. And that was Dieppe. After Dieppe, we went back to Troon to reorganise, and I was recommended for a commission by Lord Lovett, and commissioned, and the beginning of 1943 saw me as an instructor at Achnacarry.
How did you like doing that?
I liked it. I'm very fond of physical activity and sort of a purposeful way. I got promoted to captain quite quickly because the CO of the commando training centre at Achnacarry, Charlie Vaughan, great figure, had been second in command of four commando when I was in it. He remembered me as a sergeant major. And we got on fine. I went up as a second lieutenant and then became in charge of Fieldcraft. And then I had a Hayden commando, three commandos there, training commandos, about 200 people, 200 trainees. And I had Hayden commando for about a year and a bit. And then it's a full subject, really, the training at Achnacarry. Probably, well, we're reckoned to be the finest training centre, battle training centre, of World War II.
Do you think it was?
Oh, without doubt. It became the model for battle training centres throughout not only Allied forces, but post-war institutions. Many of the methods of teaching and the innovations created there were copied. It was unique. It was tough, very tough training centre. Trainees did 6 weeks, and again, if they failed at any stage, they were RTU'd, if through no fault of their own injury. They, after recovering, they were put on the next course. But there are many features of that training centre which still survive. Speed marching, the rope courses, the obstacle courses, the opposed landing, the innovations of fire and weapons, the all-round training. I've introduced in chaps to mines, not necessarily to be specialists, but knowing the nuts and bolts and the language of mines and the basic fundamental things. Now, it was a first-class training centre to which all Allied forces sent trainees on special courses. SOE sent people. In fact, I had a small squad of Germans, Germans who'd escaped from the Gestapo, from Sudetenland and that, and they became members of X Troop, number 10 commando. And I personally had 10 of those to train. I had three French, and that was a funny incident. Jolly good chaps, and they got away from France. This is early 1944, just before D-Day, and it was figured that the free that they needed a lot of reinforcements, so they were sent up, and they had done very little training, and they found we were overcrowded training reinforcements for after D-Day, and the French chaps had to go into bell tents because there wasn't enough hutted accommodation. and it rained all that May, and they were got very dispirited, and they didn't like the English food. And they said, they were really fed up. And they said they fed up with the training, fed up with the food, and they were prepared to cook their own food. They didn't like the British cooking. So I made a thing of it. I said, well, I couldn't alter the training. I'm sure they would do well if they would stick together and help each other. One of the features of Acna Carrier was a system called Me and My Pal. We tried to get chaps to link up together in pairs. So whatever tasks they had, I shared it. I shared cleaning weapons. I shared obstacle crossing. I shared when they're out in the mountains living off the land. They shared living. One would go and get firewood while the other built the bivvy. One would cook whatever there was to cook while the other cleaned weapons or got the sleeping bivouac ready. So I told the French chaps they must do that sort of thing. But certainly they could start cooking on their own. They'd have their rations, and I'd excuse one or two of them from the training to do the cooking. But after a few days, they realised that that wasn't so easy as they thought. And they came to me and said, we'd want to go back to feeding under the normal arrangements. And I made a thing of it. I said, I don't know about that. I said, the cooks are quite offended, but you didn't like their cooking. I don't know if they're prepared to cook for you again. So they said, oh, well, I try. So I said to Sergeant Major, I said, get these chaps and the cooks and take them down to a napping night, take a bit of money out of the kitty. They had always had a little bit of money for special occasions, and have some beer, and get the cooks and these free French to gel together. And they had quite a good evening, and the outcome of that was that the French chaps knocked them down, and their morale rose. And in fact, their star performer, every course ended with the competition day, which was rather a cross between cup final day and derby day. And there were two major competitions, one for the troop competition and one for the star performer, like a mini pentathlon. And to my absolute delight, one of the French chaps of this force, out of the 600 odd there, won it. A marvellous achievement. I think that did more for their morale than anything. That was a nice. And they presented me with a little flag, which I lost during the after-war years, of the Croix de Lorraine on the tricolour. So it all went happily. I had to bullshit them a bit about they cooked, you know. It went down well. So that was Acna Carrier. Could go on for about Acna Carrier for a long time. Charlie Vaughan, great figure. Cockney, joined the Brigade of Guards in World War I, survived the retreat from Mons, became a drill sergeant, and was commissioned just before the war, volunteered as an admin officer. Although we lived in billets and all that sort of thing, not in barracks, every commander had one admin officer who was like a quartermaster and a couple of clerks and storemen. And Charlie was the admin officer of 7 Commander originally. But they went out to the Middle East, as I told you, from Arran. And so Charlie came to 4 Commander. And he was a guardsman out and out, but he was a brilliant trainer. He understood human nature, and he slaughtered the King's English with his Cockney accent. And a great character. We love Charlie. But he's an awesome figure. But he knew how to get the best out of his train. He couldn't stand bullying. We're not having any bullies here among my instructors. And couldn't abide them. And he couldn't abide the bloke because he was tough when he had 3 pints of beer in him. Charlie used to say, "Can't stick you bloody hoodlums. 3 pints of beer and the smell of a barman's apron, and they want to turn the town over. I don't want them, you don't want one, but get rid of them." And they were RTU'd. No messing. And couldn't stand anybody bullshitting.
Did you go to D-Day yourself?
No. I was at Achnacarry and D-Day. After D-Day, I volunteered to go back and try to get away. Of course, Charlie, you know, he difficult to get away from. He used to say, "You're doing a marvellous job, you're all this sort of jazz." And I said, "Well, eventually I want to go back." I went back to Wrexham, and unfortunately I went parachuting and fractured my spine at a night landing. And that was the end of the war for me. When I got back, I was in plaster for several months. And then I went to the Commando Cliff Assault Centre down at St Ives, just as the war was ending, as adjutant. And then I stayed there for a year, seconded to the Royal Marines, while we were sorting out the post-war commando setup. And so I seconded to the Royal Marines at St Ives, which were basically a cliff climbing and small boat handling unit. And then I went back to the Royal Hampshires, who were at that time in Palestine. And that's another chapter.
Which years were you in Palestine?
During the terrorist period, the Haganah and the Stern Gang period, 1946 to just before the evacuation of the Royal Hampshires.
Which units of the Royal Hampshires?
First Battalion of the Royal Hampshire Regiment, and we were in Jerusalem on Minden Day, 1946, or was that 47, when they attacked us, and there's a story in its own there.
Can you go through it, please?
Well, we were... We were in Jerusalem on Minden Day, and we just got our roses because it's a battle on the day. And about 11 o'clock, there were a couple of explosions on the perimeter wire, and I was in the officer's mess, which was naturally we were having a drink. And my company billets, I had C Troop. At the time, a C company rather, I was just to the north of the little sector we had as a battalion area, and the orderly officer, a chap called Hugh Arden, second lieutenant, heard these explosions and grabbed some loaves, because even it was lunchtime by then, what we called tiffin, and grabbed half a dozen chaps, because at that time you never went anywhere without your rifle or your personal weapon and some ammunition. And he skirted round the wire and saw a couple of chaps, so they just under cover of smoke had put some parcels and were going to go over the wire, and he engaged them, and Corporal Thurley shot one and killed one and wounded two others, but they got away. And I got to the wire and saw these two parcels, and suspected they were bombs, which they were homemade bombs. And my commando training, I'd done a demolition course at before going to Achnacarry, and took these, and they were about 50 pounds of gun cotton slabs, and made them harmless. And they carried out a search, but never found the other two who got away in the Jewish sector. But we then returned to carry on the celebrations of Minden Day.
How did you render them harmless?
I beg your pardon?
How did you render them harmless?
Well, I took out the... they had a pull switch on them, and I took the... disconnected the pull switch from the fuse, and then... so that isolated the detonator, etc., from the actual explosives.
How long did it take you to do that?
About 5 to 7 minutes. That's all. It's quite easy to do. If you'd tested them for any pull switches or other booby trap devices. But once I located the type of switch,